Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
My son was a law-abiding citizen, and he did nothing wrong. He had a permit to carry. But with all of that, trying to do the right things and live accordingly by the law, he was killed by the law.
Valerie Castile there, talking about her son, Philandro, who was fatally shot by a St. Anthony, Minnesota police officer. Castile's fiancé streamed a video taken moments after the shooting on Facebook Live. It's now become infamous. She says Philandro told the officer who stopped them that he was licensed to carry a concealed weapon and he was putting his hands up when he was shot four times. The question of whether African Americans enjoy the same rights as whites was raised in several social media posts. Atlantic staff writer David Graham looked into that question and wrote The Second Amendment's Second Class Citizens. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Before we get into the history, let's talk a little bit more about this Philandro Castile shooting. Now, records show he did have a valid permit for concealed carry. Was he following proper protocol by telling the officer that who pulled him over?
It depends on who you believe. And he didn't have a legal obligation to do so in this case, based on the state rules. But a lot of people say that if you are carrying a concealed weapon and you're pulled over by the police, it's a good idea to let them know so that there are no surprises and so they understand what's going on, just in the sort of spirit of transparency.
As you note in your article, a number of observers and activists say that a white man in the same situation would not have been shot. Is there any real data to back that claim up?
It's hard to find really useful data on that. It's very hard to find really much data at all on police shootings. As we've seen over the last year, and in fact, the Washington Post and the Guardian have sort of taken up that challenge in the absence of more official statistics. So there's no way to empirically prove that. What people do is they point at these anecdotal stories where folks wield guns and are not shot versus the Castile case where he did more or less everything right and still ended up being fatally shot.
Something that I noticed in your article that I had never seen before is a website called Raw Story. They rounded up stories of white people who pointed guns at police and who were not shot. Let's hear just a clip from one of those.
Watch as the man in the red shirt and shorts walks with his hands up to his car. He gets in, then emerges with this.
Gun!
Police officers immediately shout out a warning that he's armed, then take cover.
They found 8 cases in Michigan and San Diego and Tennessee and here in New Hampshire, all very sort of defiant shows and maybe tests of whether or not police were going to shoot them and exercising, some of them said, their Second Amendment rights. Now, we know the NRA has been involved in protecting many of those rights and actively involved in similar cases and lawsuits in the past in concealed carry cases. Is there a different record for white Americans and black Americans in these cases?
That's an interesting question, and I think it depends who you ask. The NRA says, no, you know, we're a colorblind organization, and that's not the case. Now, there are black NRA members who say that, you know, the organization is overwhelmingly white. It tends to be fairly rural. It tends to be fairly politically conservative. And as a result, there just aren't as many black members, and the organization is less responsive to those concerns. Generally, the NRA will take a little bit of time responding in the cases of shootings. They tend to sort of move slowly, and I think they don't see much benefit in speaking quickly. And in the Castile case, the NRA did eventually speak out, but there was a little bit of a split, and some members of the NRA were upset and felt that the NRA had not been strong enough in its statement condemning Castile's shooting, and it hadn't been fast enough in condemning the shooting either, and they thought that was really a dereliction of duty and a betrayal of gun rights.
I think the response came out 2 days after the shooting and on their website, and it was a tweet simply saying that they didn't want to comment until all the facts were in. We did speak with the historian Gerald Horn, who's written a lot about gun laws and African Americans, and we went back with him to the first ever laws written about guns in colonial or pre-revolutionary America. This is what he had to say.
It was considered to be a violation of basic principles of security to allow enslaved Africans to have weapons. black people in the 1600s, generally speaking, were viewed either as property or as dangerous rebels who were willing to ally with foreign invaders against the rights of European settlers. And so, therefore, it would be inimical to the interests of European settlers for them to allow black people to have weapons.
So the earliest gun laws, barring the barbarous people of wild and savage natures like Native Americans and African Americans, how about after emancipation, when slave revolts were no longer a reason to keep guns from freed black people?
In the aftermath of the Civil War and during the Reconstruction period, many freed blacks in the South wanted to carry weapons to defend themselves against night riders and the Klan and groups like that. And there were black leaders who encouraged them to do so. And what happened was that some states tried to take that right away. So, for example, the South Carolina government passed a law that said that black men could not carry weapons. The Reconstruction-era governor or overseer, General Dan Sickles, tried to tamp that down. He was rejected. So in response, U.S. Congress stepped in and passed a law that said that, in fact, black men were permitted to carry guns. This is kind of one of the earliest moments where you see the federal government suggesting a personal right to bear arms as opposed to the right to form a militia. And it comes in response to this attempt to strip black men of the right to carry guns after the Civil War.
We're talking with David Graham. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he wrote about the unequal application of Second Amendment rights when it comes to African Americans. Martin Luther King applied for a concealed carry permit after his home was firebombed. He was denied, and of course, is a man who received many death threats, later assassinated. But this brings up a kind of schism in the civil rights movement, too. Nonviolent protests personified by Dr. King, and then the by any means necessary threat of Malcolm X, who you mention in your article. Now, how does he fit into this issue of African-American and Second Amendment rights?
You know, there's this famous image of Malcolm X holding a rifle and looking out of a window, and it seems to recirculate in various contexts now and then. And I think that image is sometimes interpreted as a kind of militant anti-white moment. In fact, when the photo was taken, he was armed because he was concerned that members of the Nation of Islam, which he had recently left, might come after him and try to kill him. And of course, that is exactly what happened a year after the photo was taken. But this is an example of a man trying to carry this gun for self-defense, which is, of course, the justification for concealed carry and for open carry in many cases.
So an African-American man with a gun evokes a different kind of fear, which points to another milestone that you write about for gun rights history, the Mulford Act of 1967. Tell us about what happened.
In the mid-60s, in Oakland, Black Panthers began taking advantage of the California law, which permitted open carry of weapons. And so they'd go out into the streets of Oakland on patrol, armed, and when white police would pull over black people, they would gather at the scene and observe. They said they were there basically to make sure that there was no overreach, that the cops were fair. The cops felt like they were being intimidated. And so a Republican state assemblyman introduced a bill that would ban open carry, so that sort of thing wouldn't go on. The Panthers decided that they would fight that by going to the state capitol in Sacramento with long guns, with pistols, really heavily armed, to demonstrate their right. That was a pretty serious political miscalculation, the sight of a bunch of heavily armed black men brandishing rifles in the halls of power did not, in fact, dissuade the legislature. Which promptly passed the bill. And then the governor, who was Ronald Reagan at the time, signed the bill into law. And this is a moment when, after there, you see a sort of string of gun control laws that restrict open carry and, in general ways, pull back on the right to bear arms. And these are supported by the NRA and groups like it.
Yeah, that was surprising to me. The Mulford Act restricting open carry was actually supported by the NRA. Trying to imagine the reaction to a similar showing of white people at a rally with guns. Have we ever seen such a thing in our history?
We have, though much more recently. For example, in Texas, in Austin, in January, there was an open carry rally where a bunch of gun owners, mostly white, showed up at the Capitol grounds and sort of milled around and hung out and exercised their right to bear arms openly.
How did those gun control laws, like the Mulford Act in the 60s, which were pretty much designed to restrict the use of guns by urban black leftist radicals. How did that play out in the rest of the gun right history?
There's a real shift in the NRA between the late 60s and the present. And at that time, the NRA was largely a sportsman's group. It was generally fairly, you know, important to them to carry guns, but they also supported many restrictions. And you see a switch in the organization. There was a little bit of an internal mutiny with members who felt that the organization was simply not standing up for enough rights and needed to be more aggressive. And the NRA has now become much more about open carry and concealed carry and really fighting any attempts to institute gun laws as an unlawful imposition and really a slippery slope. But you see now that the gun rights movement tends to be more white and rural versus people like the Black Panthers.
I'm thinking about back in the 80s and 90s, you know, concurrent with this shift in the NRA, we had the crack epidemic. And this is when the term black-on-black crime and news of gang shootings or drive-by shootings were really stoked up. A lot of fear for people. So how did this idea of African Americans arming up fit into this whole history that you're talking about?
It matches with the idea that, you know, the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. With people more and more concerned about the threat of crime, particularly in cities but elsewhere, the NRA and gun companies and other advocates argued that people should arm themselves, and that way if they were under threat, if someone tried to hurt them or their family, they would have a gun and that would protect them. That goes with a major growth in gun sales. And it also tracks with an increasing advocacy for open carry laws and mostly for concealed carry laws across the country.
This is a time when the legacy of race and racism is front and center in the national conversation for a lot of people. How do Second Amendment rights fit into this conversation we're having right now?
If you look at the political landscape right now, the chances of gun control, I think, are fairly low. There have been several high-profile incidents and some efforts in Congress, and obviously the president speaking out very strongly in favor of stricter laws. And in general, what we've seen is that gun laws have gotten looser across the country. So I think the question is not so much what can the country be doing to institute more gun control at this moment, but are the gun laws that we have being equally applied to all people? And I think there's a good deal of evidence to suggest that, in fact, Black Americans do not enjoy the same Second Amendment rights that white Americans do.
David Graham, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David Graham, he's staff writer at The Atlantic, and you can find a link to read his article, The Second Amendment's Second Class Citizens. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.